The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Have the changes in the banking industry affected you? With the looming possibility that your local bank branch might disappear and more web, mobile, and social technologies, what will the changes mean for you and your business? Welcome to Breaking Banks with your host, Brett King. The possibility that banking is no longer a place you go, but just something that you do, has become very real. Now, here is Brett King.
Hi, welcome back to Breaking Banks this week, July 31st, Thursday, coming to you from New York. I'm your host, Brett King. This week, before we get started with our guests we've got for you, a great guest, by the way, let's quickly track some of the rumors that are still on the web and on the Twitter sphere at the moment. These iPhone 6 NFC rumors just won't die. A French blog site reported earlier this week that they had, through one of their contacts in Taiwan, got a hold of a PCB that looked like the internal radio, one of the radio boards for the iPhone 6. And it has high-frequency RF NFC chips built into the PCB, which, if you're convinced by the circuit board, it looks like the 6 is going to have NFC. Of course, we've seen these rumors before, but it's getting pretty strong. And you can be sure if Apple is going to finally get into payments, it's because they've got a plan to own the ecosystem end to end. And it's going to be linked to iTunes in some manner, I am sure of it. So very interesting to watch this one. Not the only rumor. Amazon this week was the rumor came out through a leak of an internal document that they're thinking about launching a square-type competitor with the Amazon card reader that was leaked from this internal document, presumably because they want to give their partners and retailers access to the Amazon ecosystem out in the physical space as well. Interesting rumor that's taking place. Of course, they could just buy Square, right? I hear Square's looking for a buyer. But Square also announced this week their launch of their new EMV-capable reader. This just came out yesterday. Not to be unexpected, because with the EMV rollout, they are going to have to make sure they've got these fraud issues covered with the reader. So interesting news. Anyway, this week we have a great guest for you. A well-known, and I don't know if he likes the term futurist, but he's a well-known commentator on the area of future trends, particularly anthropology. He's the author of a book called Futuretainment, which was published by Phaidon in, if I'm correct, it was 2010. Is that right, Mike?
It was a bit earlier.
A bit earlier.
I actually, being a traditional publishing house, I wrote it in about 2006, but it took me that long to publish it.
Oh, seriously? Anyway, Mike Welsh, welcome to the show.
It's wonderful to be here, Brett.
Yeah, we've been trying to do this for, it would be probably 6 or 7 months we've been trying to get you on the show. So finally, it's a great opportunity. So Mike, one of the things I love about your bent on this, on the issues of future technology, and you've often spoken, about financial services in that space as well, but just generally more broadly, the changes that are happening in technology. You've got a really interesting view of this, which is one from the perspective of an anthropologist. So tell me how you got into this space, in this strategic space, and why anthropology is so important to inform this process of understanding what happens next.
I think, like most people that end up in strange fields, I started off as a lawyer. I had the mispleasure of actually seeing the first round of the internet boom in the 90s. I used to run a research company called Jupiter Research in Australia. And one of the things I observed, in those times was that no one really knew anything about what was happening digital in the late 90s. It was people were just making it up. But one of the sciences that kept coming back and back was this study of anthropology, because it was a study of behavior. And although we didn't know much about digital, we knew quite a bit about social sciences, about behavior, about the things that, drove actions and reward systems. And ultimately, I think in some ways, this is the best place to start if you're trying to understand whether it's a new application or a new technology, why people love things, why people do things, and ultimately why people break things.
So, you know, is there a, do you think there's a speeding up of the way technology is changing behavior, or is it sort of on a predictable curve?
It's there's a strange relationship between technology and behavior. I'm sure that many of the listeners who are in the financial tech space, you probably feel sometimes that you're in an echo chamber. I mean, you log on to Wired or onto TechCrunch, and it's just endless stories about, you know, companies getting funding or, you know, what bank is buying what startup. And you don't really get a sense of how the underlying behavior is changing. And that actually is where the most interesting parts of the whole financial revolution are. It's stuff you don't see right away. You know, I spend a lot of time in emerging markets. And one of the reasons for that is that it's often in these places like India and in Brazil and even Turkey where you see consumers doing unexpected things with mobile applications, with devices. And these are often the seeds of big changes that trickle down into broader industries. So, you know, I'll give an example. You know, so, you know, one of the areas where you saw some of the earliest disruption around mobile payments, it wasn't even Africa. It was actually the Philippines. And you know about this, Brett.
With M-Cash and Smart, yeah.
Yeah, and the funny thing was is that the point of origin around this was a problem that the telcos had, which is that they didn't have a distribution network for selling credit. They never intended it to be a form of cash. It's just that, you know, Filipino people love talking a lot, and they found that exchanging credit was actually as good as money. So it's what consumers do with things that I think is often the most interesting source of innovation.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Is there certain aspects to the smartphone that we didn't sort of see coming in respect to this behavior that you're seeing has emerged to, you know, dominantly or has been really interesting trend? Certainly like the emergence of social happening at the same time as the smartphone platform was an interesting coincidence.
I think we've barely seen the disruptive part of the mobile revolution. A lot of what we see now was, I think, directly attributable to Steve Jobs taking a lot of ideas from NTT Docomo and the Japanese, you know, feature phones. Like he saw the way they handled content, payments, entertainment, and he sort of ported it onto his idea of the phone. My actual view is in the next 5 to 10 years, mobile devices themselves will be completely meaningless.
And
that's because if you look at it now, there's not actually that much scope for innovation around the hardware. It's a piece of glass.
Right.
I mean, you can make it bigger or smaller, heavier or lighter, change the colors and put some, you know, different cases on it. But it's basically a remote control with biometrics on it. And where the real innovation is going to come is not even the software. It's actually going to be how do you put the human being at the center of the interaction. And that's really what's going to change the way we think about entertainment, the way we think about retail, financial services, payments. All mobile means to me, it's not about the technology or the device. It's about a different relationship to the human being that's sitting behind the technology.
It's very interesting. We were very focused on hardware form factor in the years gone by. If you look at the you look at the Nokia concepts from, you know, 2000 and 2005. There are all these different hardware form factors, but if anything, we've tended to sort of create more standards there that people are copying each other. But there was a tweet that went out on Tuesday morning from just reading back Bill Gross. He said, "In just 20 years, we've had a 200 times reduction in volume, 1,000 time reduction in weight, and 20 times." The speed and resolution, and he was showing a picture of a Newton, a camcorder, a laptop, a watch, a pager, a Polaroid camera, a Walkman, and one of the old Gordon Gecko mobile phones, now yeah. All compressed into an iPhone. If you extrapolate that, of course, then another 20 years, you know, we would have the processing power equivalent of an iPhone in something, you know, less than the size of a millimeter in diameter and width, and a 54 gigahertz processing speed. So you would expect that,
or not?
Okay.
See, that's the thing. I mean, we thought in entertainment that we were on this endless quest to better pictures and sound, and then MP3 turned up, and it turned out people actually wanted convenience. Like they didn't care about, you know, stripping out the frequencies. If you look at this crazy app that the kids are playing with now, Yo, I mean, this is 1-bit communications.
Yeah.
you don't need a supercomputer to run that. So I actually think to some extent this whole debate around resolution and specifications and power is going to become largely irrelevant in the same way most people don't think about electricity and how many watts right. they get.
Once we get to a particular capability, then it's invisible.
It becomes invisible.
Right.
And then I think it's a more interesting discussion, which is if you're focusing on humans and not channels, mobiles are disposable, the technology is disposable. You have to stop thinking in abstract terms, though, because, I think you're already seeing this in the payment space. It's not about technology, it's about behavior. And changing behavior is complex and expensive.
Right. So the changes we've seen in behavior, they're less attributable to someone from a commercial perspective getting people to change. It's just it's a natural use or evolution of the technology or adaptation to the technology in their life.
I think this is the really interesting question, which is, you're right. The VP of marketing of a big financial institution is the least likely person on the planet to institute a major change in behavior.
Yep.
Changes in behavior either happen by accident or they happen because someone's thought of a clever little hook. If you look what's happening in social media,
yep.
So the reason why Facebook is buying these little companies for big amounts of money, like Instagram, and they're launching things like Paper, is because what they've realized is if you're going to change a behavior, you can't have an omnibus Microsoft Office conglomerate of features. You've got to focus on a very narrow, tightly defined application. So it's not photo sharing, it's Instagram. You have to find a way to very clearly articulate the payoff around a new behavior.
Right.
That's how ideas spread. The reason why Apple's been so successful is that they don't launch things until they can think end-to-end about the experience or the new behavior they want to achieve. If with a new iPhone 6 they make a hard push into payments, it's because they've thought end-to-end about how they want that to work, and they won't do it until they've done it.
They like to own the ecosystem end-to-end, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And I think that's other players don't realize how expensive and how difficult it is. I mean, BlackBerry Bold has had NFC for years, and no one ever used it because it was a feature. It wasn't experience.
Now, one of the things that I've been really interested in recently is the explosion, and it's not necessarily recently, but the explosion of new stars on social media, like the Viners, the likes of PewDiePie and Michelle Phan and things like this. In respect to these types of social uses of the social platforms in these ways and creating new forms of influence, are we just seeing something that is akin to the movie stars of MTV but on the new media platform, or is it something different?
You secretly want to become an internet celebrity, don't you, Brett?
I thought I already was, Mike.
No. I mean, you're famous. No, but you want 3 billion followers.
No, I don't think. Felix Arvid, I tell this story on the speaking circuit, but, I took my daughter to Good Day New York in the Fox Studios to see me tape a breakfast segment there, and she thought that was pretty cool. But when she found out I was friends with PewDiePie on Facebook, wow, that's cool, Dad.
But my personal view is that this whole thing is entirely random. The system creates people like PewDiePie because it needs someone who has that many followers. Right. But it's actually totally arbitrary who that is, and you can never recreate it. And there's no science behind it. It's just a logical endpoint of a system built on networks. Someone has to be the most famous kid.
Yeah, absolutely. We see a lot of effort at the moment going into things like understanding influence, clout scores, and there's a new platform out of the UK that's just being launched called Screditable. We also saw LinkedIn acquisition of Newsl, which is sort of a ranking for your PR and news capability. Is there anything to this, the ability to measure influence? If can you really influence it?
It is absolutely something to this, and there's absolutely no way that any of these current systems come anywhere near it. Like, this is quite a big topic, Brett. I think we should get into this because if you think about it, it's very closely linked to this idea of credit scores and, you know, the way we profile risk, you know, in the banking system. I think we do a terrible job of this at the moment.
Absolutely.
And I think this is something we should talk about probably in the next segment.
Okay, good. Well, let's do that. Let's have a quick break. And after the break, we can come back and we'll get into social influence and also talk about some of the more quirky stuff you found on your travels, because I love some of the stories you bring back from these emerging markets. In fact, you live in Turkey, right?
I spend some time here. I've got a few bases where I leave luggage, and one of them is in Istanbul.
So what attracted you to Turkey?
My wife.
There you go. That's a pretty good reason. All right, great. Well, you're listening to Breaking Banks. We're interviewing Mike Walsh, the author of Futuretainment, and also his more recent book, 10 Ways to Survive the Future, which is an e-book. We'll be right back after this quick break.
Comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Attend Payments 2014 to meet the forward-thinking leaders and disruptors who are transforming how we pay and get paid. Get a glimpse into the next wave of payments innovations and challenges through fast-paced interactive demonstrations, educational sessions, and a buzzing exhibit hall. Register now at payments.nacha.org. Payments 2014 is presented by NACHA, the Electronic Payments Association, the recognized leader in payment system education. The Payments Conference, transform imagination into strategic innovation. Register today at payments.nacha.org.
Have you friended us on Facebook yet?
Why not?
Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for the keywords Voice America. Once you are part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the Voice America Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our wall. Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for Voice America.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. We are transmitting from New York today, and we have Mike Walsh coming in all the way from Istanbul in Turkey, where he maintains a resident right in the midst of emerging markets. Mike, where other markets do you spend time in most frequently?
I'm all over. I've been spending a bit of time in India lately and also Brazil and, of course, China. If it's an unusual place, you'll probably find me there at some point.
And I like one of the things that I really like about following you, particularly on your blog and your YouTube posts and your Facebook travels and so forth, is that you really do ferret out some of these really interesting case studies. I first learned about Miku, the Japanese virtual pop star, from watching your feed. And of course, the NFC payment stuff is not new in places like Japan. So what do you find in these places, or how do you go through that process of tracking down some of these really interesting anthropological case studies or emerging interests that you find in these far-flung markets?
I tell you, life would be a lot simpler if there was just an RSS feed I could subscribe to. but generally, it's the hard way. You find them completely by accident and by immersing yourself in these markets. And I guess one of the things I'm often looking for is what I call divergences. So I'm looking for where an existing technology has been morphed and adapted by a local population or a local culture. It's kind of the 21st century equivalent of, you know, you and I are old enough to remember this, but the gods must be crazy, you know, where they discover the Coke bottle. And I think for me that's where the real magic happens, is that if you can see how these technologies are used in new ways, it gives you an insight not only into the possibilities of technology, but really just how human behavior as a whole is changing. So I'll give you an example. What you might have come across this app called FireChat. It's about 3 months old, was born out of San Francisco, was designed for hipsters to stay in touch on trams or wherever they were out of range. But the thing that blew, I think, the founders away was when they discovered that the number one market for FireChat was not San Francisco. It was Iraq.
Wow.
It's now become the number one messaging application for people in war-torn Iraq. And that's because it turns out this model of mesh communications, mesh networking, of distributing messages in an offline context is exactly what you need when the government's trying to block your communications channels or knocking out cell towers.
It's incredible.
Yeah. So, you know, for me, this is, you know, this is often where you see the most interesting uses of technologies, when they kind of escape the labs and escape what founders think they're meant to be used for.
Are there particular markets where you consistently see this, or is it just random, totally random?
I don't think it's random, but I think it generally follows a few rules. Where there's a young population, where there's a kind of a rapid dispersal of mobile technologies, where mobile broadband is fairly cheap and easily accessible. These are kind of the places where you have focal points for disruptive change in behavior. Look, it used to be Japan. Right. I used to make regular pilgrimages to Japan, and going to Japan was like going into the future.
Yeah.
Now going to Japan is like going to an alien planet. I mean, things evolve there that will never evolve anywhere else.
Right.
So it's less predictive, I think. And I think in the last 5 years, I've had to adjust my travel schedule to look for places that are more useful.
Interesting. I mean, we look at M-Pesa's always held up as one of those fantastic examples in the payment space, mobile payment space, because it's been so phenomenally successful in Kenya.
But and yet hard to replicate.
Exactly. That was the point I was going to make. It's we haven't been able to, you know, we tried it in Afghanistan and we've tried it in South Africa and other places.
Yeah.
It just hasn't worked with the same intensity or success that we saw in Kenya. So is that cultural element sort of that magic piece? If you understand that the culture that you're going into, that you might have a distinct advantage in terms of adoption of your technology?
Yeah, I think culture is definitely an accelerator. But so are also the existence of alternatives. There wasn't an ATM network in Kenya, so there was really no other alternative. But culture is definitely a very interesting phenomenon. And it's not just, you know, exotic cultures that you're looking at. I mean, there are distinct cultures in cities. There are distinct cultures in corporations. There are reasons why enterprise social networking works in one company but doesn't work in the other, or works among certain employees in one country but not in another. So culture is always an important factor with any kind of new innovation.
So how does an anthropologist, I mean, how do you classify yourself as a futurist, an anthropologist, as a research, you know, I don't know, how do you explain yourself?
I try not to classify myself. I you know, in general, I just follow the things that interest me. But, you know,
it's a great way to live.
I mean, you know, increasingly, I guess when I first started out, I was really fascinated by how consumer behavior was changing. And I think in the last, I would say, 18 months to 2 years, where I've been really focusing my attention is to try and understand how organizations are changing. And if you think about the finance space, which I know you and a lot of your listeners look at, it's very easy to say that, you know, there's a new generation of consumers, they want banking to be mobile, they think differently about payments. But if you look at this from an organizational perspective, this is where the real nightmare is. I mean, if I can think of one tough job to have in this day and age, it would be the CIO of a major financial institution. I mean, these guys are between a rock and a hard place.
Absolutely.
I mean, they've got their board and their investors saying, why can't we be more like, you know, PayPal and, you know, Square and Moovin, you know.
Yep.
And then you've got on the other side, you've got the regulators and, you know, the advocacy groups saying you have to protect our data and you have to, you know, comply with regulations. So it's a really tough job to have at the moment. But in a sense, these are the people who are going to who've got the ability to impact the lives of millions of people. It's not just the startups.
Absolutely. So how do you start the conversation with an organization, or where do you find you're able to help organizations most effectively?
You know, where I find that I'm doing the most interesting work at the moment is bridging the gap between emerging technologies and changing patterns of human behavior. I think a couple of years ago, everyone was focused on the technology. So
right.
they were coming out and saying, look, this is a disruptive new way to do X, or this is the device you've got to use. And some organizations bought into this. You know, they bought iPads for everyone. They put in an enterprise social network. And then largely nothing happened. It's because the hardest thing to hack is often not the technology. It's actually how do you hack the organizational structures? How do you understand not upgrading the system, but upgrading the DNA of people and how they work? So this is where the biggest change, I think, is happening now in companies. You know, you see this in finance with a lot of banks and financial institutions are trying to work out what they do with their financial advisors.
Yeah.
I mean, they know intuitively that this has got to change and that technology is replacing a lot of things, but there's still some evidence that people are an important part of the whole equation.
So how does that interface change, and where is the new value to be had?
Well, I think it's interesting what's happened in the wealth management space. So a lot of banks realized that traditional wealth management was much too expensive to run, you know, for individuals. I mean, they're having to build mahogany offices and a very expensive go-to-market strategy. So a lot of players, I guess, have either moved upscale and treating, you know, individuals like institutions, or they got out of the market. But at the same time, you've got these new companies like Wealthfront, you know, which take
Betterment and Covesta.
And they take a kind of almost like an Apple approach to the problem, which is, you know, you can actually deliver fantastic service, the kinds of tools that only traditionally institutions used to have access to, with a smart interface, and you can actually offer it fairly cheaply to people who normally wouldn't get it. So this is the idea, I think, looking at these segments, not in terms of how much does it cost us to do it, but can we actually deliver the essence of this with technology in a new way?
Mm. And I think there's an interesting element to that, which, you know, going back to the discussion on Steve Jobs and Johnny Ives in particular, this design focus that they had, making the interaction with the hardware more human. You know, there seems to be a lot more focus on that, not, and it's not human factor from a sort of a usability or heuristics perspective anymore, but it's that design element which it appears to be something that's really new, that new skill set. Because when we look at interactions between corporations and customers, they're generally speaking, the technology we've had the last 30, 40 years has defined a lot of those interactions for us. Is that a skill set that corporations are grappling with right now, this design element?
Absolutely, because in particular, it's not actually object or industrial design, it's experience design we're talking about.
Right.
And you need to have an end-to-end approach to that. You can't just have your marketing team go, we're going to design an amazing onboarding experience, and then for someone to be dumped into, you know, like, you know, the horrible call center or a horrible, you know, a account management service. So true experience design is kind of one of the most difficult skills to do, because it requires almost like an override on every part of the organization that touches the consumer. And most organizations aren't structured that way. They're structured around functional departments.
So does this require new metrics, or what's going to drive this? Is it just going to be, you know, competition from startups, or you know, what's going to be the imperative for corporations to get out of this, you know, siloed-based approach where you can't really get end-to-end experiential improvement.
I don't actually believe this is just going to be driven by startups. And I think startups are definitely a catalyst. I don't believe they're the solution. I think that there's going to be a lot of big institutions that buy startups hoping that will fix the problem, but it yep. won't. It'll be great for the startups.
Well, we hope so.
but it won't ultimately solve the problem, because I think the only way you're going to get real change is by the organizations refactoring what they do and refactoring it based on the consumer. So it's kind of almost glib to say that you have to be a customer-facing organization, but to be honest, very few institutions or organizations actually really think about what that means, which is redesigning the entire experience from a customer perspective. And that's kind of the touchstone that I think of the next wave of transformation that we're going to see.
Very interesting. We talked about the influence piece before, so let's come back to that. In terms of communities that start to gravitate around, you know, certain products or certain services, how is that online dialogue and the transparency issue, the sort of the flow of information, affecting credibility of organizations in respect to this sort of element of design and their responsiveness to their customers?
Well, I think what you're asking is that if you're an influential person on social media and through networks, should you be treated better? At the moment, this is kind of a broken system in that the only way you can really explain to people that you are significant is if you start complaining loudly on Twitter.
Yeah.
Which, to be honest, even if I have a very significant network, I don't actually want to do that, because I think it's a horrible thing to do for your own personal brand, to use your social media accounts to kind of start a proxy war against another brand.
Right.
So, you know, I wouldn't even
might
do it.
Might reduce your credibility.
I think it reduces my credibility.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like it's like going thermonuclear. And so I think it's a very inefficient approach. I tend to unsubscribe from people, you know, who use their own platforms to rail against brands and customer service.
Although I will tell you a story I had about HSBC one day where I wrote on Huffington Post.
I know. I read that. And, you know, but you shouldn't have to do that.
No, you're right. You're right. That was my point of writing the article. But
yeah. So I think it's kind of sad that you did have to do it. So I think that a lot of these existing metrics like clout and things, you know, I've played with them, but I don't ever get the sense that they really accurately reflect the individual nature of someone's relationship with a brand. They're good at picking out who the people are generally who are followed by people.
Right.
But to be honest, some person you've never heard of who no one will ever follow for anything could be very important for one particular brand in a particular context. And we miss that at the moment, because the only real source of that data is the source of the data that exists between that customer and the brand. And that's the one place where the brand's not looking.
In terms of these mechanics, in the past we've seen a lot of work on things like, SEO, search engine optimization and things like that. Are we reaching the limit of our ability to manufacture that, where it just is now going to be, because of transparency, you just honestly have to fix the problems to be able to have real influence?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, people are going to be annoyed by this, but I think SEO is a complete waste of time.
Yeah.
I think the only thing that matters is generating relevant content.
Yeah.
And being totally authentic about that. And then working out from that content what things people are interested in and then giving them more of them.
Yep, good. Well, look, that's a good point to have a break on. So let's have a quick break, and Mike, we'll have you back on just after the break. You're listening to Breaking Banks. We're going live on Voice America Business Channel and on AM 1160 in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back after this break.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Your bank's customers expect comprehensive, convenient, and consistent service when and where they need it. A mobile app is a great start, but with so many devices and operating systems out there, it can be hard to keep up with demand. That's why today's leading banks count on the Kony Multichannel Experience Cloud. With Kony, you can design, develop, and manage multi-channel apps from one integrated platform. Build an app once, and with one click, you can deploy it securely across all digital channels, phones, tablets, desktop, and more. That means more efficiency for you and a better experience for your customers. Want to get to market fast? Explore Kony's range of ready-to-run apps, including retail, commercial, and private banking. With features like person-to-person transfers, targeted campaigns, built-in integrations, and cutting-edge compliance, Kony apps provide the framework and flexibility you need to rise above the competition. Go beyond first-generation mobile banking. Visit kony.com/BK to launch your multi-channel strategy. That's KONY.com/BK.
We're making it easier to listen to the Voice America Talk Radio Network live wherever you go on iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android. Download it from the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
You're listening to Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. We have on the show with us today Mike Walsh, the author of Futuretainment. And Mike, you also run a blog called The Fourth Estate. And where else can people find out information about Mike Walsh?
Of course, on Twitter. So I definitely would encourage you to follow me on Twitter.
And your Twitter ID is
Mike Walsh.
Yep.
Just, yeah, I got in early enough.
Good.
And of course, on Facebook as well. I've got a public profile that I publish quite a bit of content there as well.
Great. And you're on the speaking circuit. You're one of the more respected speakers out there speaking about this. So that's available through your personal website?
Yeah. If you just put Mike Walsh into Google, you'll find me.
Absolutely. Great. Before the break, we were talking about sort of the social elements and things like that. But looking 5 to 10 years out, what are some of the technologies that you're really closely watching, or some of the trends that are happening that really interest you in terms of where we're going to take this over the next few years?
A couple of months ago, I met Ray Kurzweil, which was really fascinating. And absolutely fascinating. And then if you look at where the big major tech players are putting their money right now, it'll give you a bit of a sense of where we're going to go in the next 5 to 10 years. And all the big money is now flowing into areas like artificial intelligence, robotics, drones, sensors. And this is part of a much bigger picture, which is we're kind of moving out of this kind of first and second wave of the internet. If you think about the first wave being dominated by search, and then it was about mobile. What we're moving into now is really as machines start to get smarter. I mean, Google actually believed that in the future, if you have to search for something, they've failed, because they actually need to know what you're looking for before you actually look for it, before even you know it. So eventually when you get into your car, your GPS should actually have your destination in it before you tell it.
Yep. It should know from the other information available.
Of course. It should know from your calendar, from your social media, from your messaging. This is just the beginning, I think, of a kind of a new relationship that we're going to have with computers, especially important when screens disappear because of wearables. So this kind of race, Google are actually trying to build now a digital neocortex, is kind of the next wave of computing. I've heard you make this comment before, Brett, that the kind of mobile phones of today are equivalent to the supercomputers that the banks had in the 80s.
And
I think that's very true. And I think if we were to say in 10 years' time, if you had a supercomputer in a bank, what would you actually do with it?
That's a good question.
Presumably it wouldn't be, to to play Angry Birds.
Absolutely.
Although, did you see this week there's a Swedish bank that just launched a version of Flappy Bird to attract new savers?
I didn't, but I did see that there was a bank that had launched Doom on one of their ATMs, so I thought that was interesting. But
That's just wonderful. So this is an interesting question. You know, what would a supercomputer do at a bank in 10 years' time? And, you know, for me at least, I think one of the enduring problems that banks have is how do you identify a good customer? And that problem is going to get harder because, you know, all the traditional measures of how banks used to look at traditional good customers is shifting. I mean, when I got my first bank loan, when I was 23 was the easiest loan I ever got. It's when I had the least amount of money.
Yep.
It was when I was the biggest risk, but I had a normal job. And because I'd studied law, I got a professional discount of 1%.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I didn't know lawyers got discount on loans.
You know what? Lawyers and doctors get a professional discount in some of the Australian banks, still to this day.
Wow.
And it's kind of a very antiquated view of looking at risk.
It is.
If you look at people today, some of the wealthiest people look the worst on paper.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't have a normal job. They might be freelancers.
Right.
They've got incredible cash flow, but, if they're smart enough, they even structure their fares to look like they're losing money.
Yeah. Well, I found when I moved to the US, the fact that I didn't have a meticulously crafted credit score, I was hopeless. I couldn't get any credit. And yet, if you look at the fundamentals, my fundamentals, then, and as is now that I've got actually a good credit score, I'm getting five, pre-approved credit applications in the mail each week. It's like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So I think, if I was a bank and I had a supercomputer, I think that would be one task I would definitely look at it, which is, what am I not seeing here? You know, if you said to Watson, the answer is a great credit risk, what's the right question?
Mm.
Yeah.
I'm very interested to see where this machine learning takes us, because right now what we're seeing is efforts to get machines to learn, but the way they're learning and the way they're correlating information and connecting the dots, Watson's been evidence of this, but clearly that machines by their nature are probably going to think about this quite differently. And some of it may be because they're very focused on a singular problem, or some of it just must be that the evolution of these intelligence might differ. It's very, very interesting. What is Kurzweil says 2029, I think, doesn't he? For
I don't believe in the singularity at all.
Okay.
Do you believe in a multiplicity? I like a lot of people grew up with Star Wars, so we all kind of imagine that at some point the robots are going to turn up. But I think it really is more emblematic of our own kind of pop culture biases than any real reality. It's actually quite interesting. In the late 90s, Garry Kasparov famously lost to IBM's chess computer. But what people don't realize is what he did next, which was he actually worked quite extensively with computer chess programs. And what he demonstrated was that, yes, a very good computer can beat a grandmaster at chess.
Mm.
But what he also showed was that even more powerful is if you combine an average computer with a average human being and a strong workflow. That can beat either a supercomputer or a grandmaster.
Wow.
So the issue is not whether computers are going to replace human beings, or whether we're going to have to plan for a robot revolution, or banks will be stripped of all of their staff and there'll just be a couple of supercomputers and and a mobile app. The real question is that what is the most optimal workflow between very clever computers, smart data insights into changing behavior, and human beings? If computers are going to automate more of the transactional parts of financial institutions, the real question is, what do the human beings do? How do they elevate their role? How do they be more strategic? How do they add value? And I think this is going to be the real 21st century question that big banks and financial institutions are going to have to ask themselves, which is not how do we launch a new mobile app for our consumers, but what do our people do?
Yeah. How do they continue to bring value?
Exactly. And I think a big part of it is going to be navigating complexity. You know, we spoke earlier about, you know, financial advisors.
Yep.
And if you look in the UK, they went independent, you know, a while ago. And the ones that have survived largely because they're helping consumers navigate a very complex financial environment. Yes, they can do things alone. They can do things themselves on the internet, but it's complex.
And complexity has been one of the hallmarks of the financial services industry, particularly. It seems to be getting more complex with regulation and so forth. But, you know, we see a lot of efforts at removing this complexity and removing friction. Some of that's happening through experiential design. But do you see systemic changes happening in banking and finance? For example, you know, we talk about money. And transmission of money and payments. So what are your thoughts on cryptocurrencies and things like Bitcoin?
Don't say the word Mt. Gox to me.
I hear you.
I think I'm one of the claimants in the class action suit. Reid Hoffman said it very well. You know, he said, you know, the issue is not whether or not cryptocurrencies are here to stay. The question is whether or not Bitcoin is going to be the cryptocurrency because, you know, cryptocurrencies are not so much a technological invention as a philosophical debate. The blockchain's a fascinating thought construct, which is there a way that we can think about money in a completely different way that isn't controlled by institutions or third parties? Yeah. In a sense, we have to solve the global roaming problem of money.
Right.
Global roaming is a horrible kind of function of the current telecommunications landscape. But money has a lot of similar problems.
You know, one of the challenges here is not so much just transmission of money. I think we are getting better at that. But some of the core systems some of the core complexities in the system today are things like risk and, you know, compliance. And, you know, the blockchain doesn't solve the problem of assessing risk or offering credit, you know.
It doesn't. No. The blockchain is just more of, I guess, a kind of a concept of, you know, eliminating some of the kind of the gatekeepers out of the system. You know, the other issue with money, of course, is just the whole thing of exchange rates. The US dollar for a long time was kind of the default currency, but then the minute America started printing money, a lot of people started to wonder, is this actually the best reserve currency that we should actually be denominating as a neutral basis on all international deals?
I mean, currencies themselves were created in an effort to sort of create common value exchanges. So as you see these cultures coming together, you know, particularly if you look at China and the massive, you know, they're far more successful at mobile commerce than the US as it stands today. When you start to see some of these cultures changing and shifting, are there synergies in respect to the way payments are working that need to be addressed cross-border like that, or is it more about more efficient foreign exchange mechanisms, do you think?
That's a very deep question. I definitely think that in markets like China, there's innovation around digital currency. It may not be the Chinese will originate the platform that we all use, but they may come up with ways of using it that we haven't expected. I don't think it's any accident that a lot of the innovation around wealth management has already come from China, you know, with the entry of Baidu and Alibaba into the wealth management space. And that was for entirely practical reasons. I mean, the simple fact was these big internet companies in China had more information on consumers than banks did. I mean, they knew more about potential credit risks than Chinese banks did.
Yeah.
So, you know, their
mobile money market fund, we talked about that a couple of weeks ago on the show. It's been phenomenally successful.
Exactly. Yeah. But, I mean, you know, they ran a pilot on that way before they launched that, where Jack Ma was providing information to banks about people's behavior in Taobao, because he was sitting on all of this potential proxies for credit risks. So, you know, we're all talking about Amazon launching a phone. I mean, the question, or Amazon doing payments, but could Amazon be a bank?
Yeah.
Would they even want to be?
Well, they're offering credit facility, as PayPal is now, to small businesses. So, as is Alipay in China. It's interesting that, lending actually predates banking. Maybe that's the way the digital economy is going in that respect. We'll start with lending and payments, and then figure out we don't need banking in the form that we have it today.
You can always break those two things apart. I mean, for me, payments, how we handle money, a lot of that is a construct of the inherent problems of money itself. We've just digitized the problems.
Right.
We can move electronically different currencies around, but we've still got currencies. So I think there's going to be solutions and debates around that separate of this issue of banking. For a lot of people, the core of banking is actually access to finance, access to the ability to borrow money. I mean, that's really when they're buying a house or they're thinking about their future, that's really what they're trying to solve. And still the challenge for that is that how do you really work out as a financial institution whether someone's a good credit risk or not?
Mm, yeah.
And that's about data.
Yeah, absolutely. No. So listen, we've only got a few minutes left, Mike. So tell us about what is coming up for you and, what you've got planned the next few months.
I've had a crazy year of speaking. I was on main stage at Million Dollar Round.
How many countries do you think you've spoken at in the last 12 or 18 months?
I have no idea, but I worked out by March I'd already been in 40 cities.
Wow.
At about 20 countries.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah. I've spoken everywhere from Saudi Arabia this year, right through to obscure parts of the United States. I'm doing a lot of work in Norway these days. I've joined a board of a large advertising group there. So it's been busy, but I've taken 2 months off, these 2 months, because what I've realized is the one thing I actually need to do is what I haven't been doing, which is do more thinking and more writing.
Mm. Yeah, well, we look forward to – are you writing something at the moment?
I am. I'm writing a new book, and it's got to do with what we've been discussing, which is – I think we understand well about how consumers are changing their behavior, but the real and most interesting question to me now is going to the future: how do companies redesign themselves for the 21st century?
Mm. Very, very interesting. Well, I hope we can get you back on the show to launch the book when it's ready.
I hope you can as well. Thanks,
Fred. Mike Walsh, author of Futuretainment. Have you got a title for the new one?
No.
Okay.
Follow me on Twitter and I'll tell you.
Cool. Mike Walsh, it's been great to have you on the show from Istanbul today. We look forward to having you back on the show and grateful for your insights.
Thanks, bro.
So that's the Breaking Banks episode for this week. If you want to catch up on some of our older episodes, don't forget you can go to breakingbanks.com or you can check out Breaking Banks on iTunes with the podcast and download from there. In the next couple of weeks, we've got some really interesting shows coming up. August the 7th, we're going out live from on the AM band, 1160, and we have as our launch on that band a very interesting show planned with some live crosses to some of our international correspondents. So take care. We'll see you guys again next week on Breaking Banks. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern time on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll explore more changes and challenges next week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.